Heyman is great. I don't even need to tell you. But he's a little high maintenance, no? He asks a lot of his followers. If I had a coven of devoted worshippers, I would be a lot easier to please. You just need to see that I never run out of premium, freshly roasted coffee, which is easier than ever with Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are certified free trade and nut-free. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, but the best part is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or go for their autopilot, set it, and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Life is short. Drink better coffee. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
May I just say...
Top 100 Project
and action.
Howdy hi, ladies and gents, and thanks for popping the top on the Next 136 Project, the classic movies podcast that hits the streets nearly every Monday. We were off last week, so that's why it's not every Monday. If you weren't aware, we've already posted chats about the 123 American Film Institute Top 100 Movies from the 1998 and 2007 lists. They're all online and they're all free. Those have spoilers, and so will today's talk have some mighty spoilers. I'm the weird kid who should have learned to keep his head inside the car, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who bashes her face into her desk the same day she becomes the supernatural leader of a very odd cult, my wife Bev.
That's me. You're doing it wrong.
It's part of the fun of it. I find it easier to do the old lollipop, lollipop. See, I know I did
you
it better.
You just did it, yeah.
I know, but it's more fun the other way. Charlie would be great at lollipop, lollipop. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Hereditary. Toni Collette has played a mother in several horror flicks. The Sixth Sense, Fright Night, Krampus, and of course Hereditary. Which of the four has the best Rotten Tomatoes reviews? Which was the most financially successful? And which is your favorite? So a couple of factual things and then very much an opinion thing.
I have to guess. I'm going to say that the most financially successful one was Sixth Sense.
Oh yeah, by a lot.
Rotten Tomatoes, I'm going to say Hereditary?
Correct.
Oh, nice. Which was also my favorite, which is why I guessed it. I thought critics would like it best. It would have the least... backlash, Fright Night, and what was the other
Krampus.
One? Krampus. Yeah, those are movies that are good. I like them.
Their reviews are fine, but they're in the 70s, and Sixth Sense is around 85. This could change, because we're recording this long before we post this podcast, because we got to get ahead of things for our vacation. But at the moment, Sixth Sense is at 85%, and Hereditary is at 89%.
Yeah, I knew that Hereditary had 89. That's pretty good for Rotten Tomatoes.
And why is Hereditary not at 99%? Okay, after first seeing the light of day at Sundance and other festivals in 2018, Hereditary was released by A24, and they're a burgeoning production company, in June of just this past year. The picture had a small budget, but it turned a nice profit for A24. All right, Bev, explain this very deep and interesting film that's not even a year old with the Hereditary scale.
Oh boy. Toni Collette is Annie, an artist and a mom with family history of mental illness. Annie's recently deceased mom was a member of some demon-worshipping cult, and she probably let that demon possess Annie's daughter Charlie, but BAM! Charlie gets beheaded, and Annie kind of goes off the rails, and then she throws Charlie's book in the fire, and oh my god, her husband burns up! And then the demon possesses Annie, but just long enough to really mess with her son, and oh my god, she's on the ceiling, bro! And then she beheads herself, and then the demon possesses her son Peter, which was kind of the plan all along.
That's the whole plot, so I guess the podcast is done. All right, well, see you next week. See you in February. No, actually, there's a lot more to go. This might be a very long podcast, in fact. So, in a nutshell, Treehouse of Horror. The Simpsons have nothing on these treehouses, or this treehouse, of very much horror. Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. Like I said, 89% of critics liked the film. 280 fresh, 35 rotten. 35. What's wrong with you people? But only 63% of audiences. What's wrong with you people? It was 65th at the 2018 U.S. box office. That could still change, I guess, because something could still lap the field. Movies from last year are still coming out and getting more money and all that. But as we record this, 65th. That was the same amount of money as a movie that I've not seen, but you did, and it won the Score Golden Globe, Best Music Score. And that's First Man. We're going to talk about the score for Hereditary as we go along here. But First Man should have been a blockbuster, I guess. Damien Chazelle, Ryan Gosling, Neil Armstrong, and Hereditary did just as well as that did. Black Panther, of course, was number one in 2018, and that will not change at this point.
I thought Avengers was the highest-grossing movie of 2018.
Worldwide, it was, by quite a lot. But Black Panther domestically made about $20 million more than Avengers Infinity War. Although Disney has the top three hits again, as they had, I think, just last year, because Incredibles 2 was number three. So they own Marvel, they own Pixar, and of course they have their own product as well. And they'll soon own Fox. So when they redo the X-Men, they'll probably have a big hit that year, whenever that might happen, when they do Wolverine and such all over again. Okay, before we get into our main thoughts, I got to promote something that deserves to be promoted. I said this 2 weeks ago before we went on vacation. If you want to know more about this movie, there's an excellent spoiler review by Dan Merle and Roth Cornett from Screen Junkies on YouTube. So look up Screen Junkies News. It's 46 or so minutes. And if you already know the movie, and you really should have seen this movie before we talk about it now, or they talk about it, they'll tell you so many things you didn't really ever think about. Great stuff. If they ever do a commentary on that DVD, and they didn't, I watched everything that's on the Blu-ray just a couple of hours ago. There isn't much. But if they ever redo the thing for some reason, yeah, let Ari Aster, the director and writer, do a commentary. Let Dan and Roth do one too. They were great. So anyway, I know you're a fan of this movie. I definitely am too. What are your thoughts on a movie that's not even a year old, our last movie in the month of Hereditary?
Yeah, we've kind of tipped our hand here. You and I are both firmly in the chorus of people who are just crazy about Hereditary. It has a layered, brilliant, and totally original script. The performances are out of this world. I know everyone is rightly talking about Toni Collette, who has spent the last 2 decades being one of the best actors in Hollywood, but Alex Wolff did something that I still haven't recovered from. It's also visually astounding. Each frame of this film is both beautiful and in service of the plot or the theme. For those of us who have a real appetite for darkness in our art, Hereditary is a 3-course meal.
In our art and in our heart. Both of those places.
We both like things bleak. I think I especially really love things to be nihilistic and dark. And this movie really delivers. On top of just being a well-crafted piece of work. I think that darkness, though, is the reason why it only has 89 on Rotten Tomatoes and 66 with audiences. Which also actually 63. But also, it's because it wasn't marketed properly. It was just marketed like a traditional horror film. And I don't think that left people prepared for a movie that, well, it has some good scares. No jump scares.
There's one.
There is?
Yeah. When she runs out of the corner in the living room.
Okay, I guess so.
You screamed.
Yeah. If you don't spot her, yeah, it's true. But it doesn't rely on jump scares the way most movies do. And it's scary, but it's really quite a bit more unsettling than it is scary. And the parts that are the most memorable and affecting aren't because they scared you, but because they troubled you and haunt you till the day we die. I will be haunted by some of the stuff that happens in this movie.
Earlier this afternoon, I watched the bonus material, so that's pretty much just the making of the 20-minute thing, and the deleted scenes, for that matter. But I also did watch the very opening shot, and then the last maybe 10 or 15 minutes of the film. It was still daylight, it was still bright down here. And I'm going to tell you, I saw the movie twice now, once in the theater, once with you. I've watched some stuff on YouTube, but this was the day where I was creeped out the most. Again, still daylight down here. We talked recently about how I don't get scared when we do stuff like escape rooms, where we did one that was a horror theme. We talked about that again with our friends recently. And usually horror films don't freak me out. And this one didn't really freak me out the first 2 times watching it. But just watching a little bit of it today got under my skin more than the other times did.
Which parts? What about it?
Well, I guess the ending. It's the whole thing where people are just in the guy's house. And they're naked. It's one of the most unsettling things. Because nudity, when you do it like this, it's not at all titillating. And these people are very ordinary looking. I freeze framed a few times. I got up close to the screen to really see things like Toni Collette's face when she's hanging in the ceiling before she, well, you don't really see it happen, but falls down, jumps down. Then she's in the corner. She's doing all kinds of weird teleporting things. We'll get into that in a minute. But when I looked closer at things like the nudity, people in the corners, people over here, people over there, I love the fact that they're ordinary looking. In fact, they're dumpy looking. And that's what's so unsettling. They're naked in the forest at one point. There's 3 of them standing in the woods with no clothes on. It's one thing to be in the house or to be in that treehouse with nothing on. But to be standing out in the middle of nowhere, maybe in the dead of summer, that's not so bad, but it's got to be cold. And these are human beings. There are some non-human beings in this movie, apparently, including when people are possessed. But these people seem to be very real.
There's something so subversive about nudity when it's not used in the traditional sense. We talked about this a little bit when we did our History of Violence podcast. Nudity naturally is usually used to be titillating, but when you stray from that and you use it as an expression of anger, as it is in History of Violence, or in this case, as just like an expression of...
supplication?
It's not the supplication. I think it's a total disregard for norms. These are people who, I don't want to say should be ashamed to be seen naked, but wouldn't display their bodies to be seen. It has nothing to do with that. They're, like you said, average-looking people. People in late middle age.
Older people, yeah.
Yeah.
Not even middle age, but their retirement age.
And they're not embarrassed mm-hmm. to be standing there. They haven't been caught nude. They are trying to impress anybody. There's something so incredibly subversive about someone who would be driven to behave that way. When you see someone acting like that, a middle-aged woman just standing there naked in your house coming from out of nowhere, then you have no idea what she's going to do next.
People that know this movie know about the guy in the entranceway, the closet, whatever it is. We saw him earlier at the funeral. Charlie notices him, fully clothed, of course. And he's at Ellen, her grandmother's funeral, smiling at her then. Now he's smiling at Alex. Here's the thing I noticed by watching it again today. He barely seems to move, just like Annie barely seems to move when she's planted in the corner of first his bedroom and then the living room. I wonder if in the bedroom it was just some kind of dummy, because it didn't have to be a person. But because I got up close to the screen, I could see Toni Collette must be strapped up there, because they do a rack focus. Alex Wolff first is in focus, and you can see her behind if you look at all closely. But when they rack focus to her face, she's up there.
Yeah.
And I thought, is she smiling? Is she doing anything weird? No, she just has a look on her face. She's possessed at this point, obviously. The fact she can do these things proves that. But when Peter turns and looks at the guy in the doorway, first he's basically facing him straight on, smiling, naked, all that kind of thing. Then it cuts to Peter's face, I believe, but it cuts to a different shot. It goes back to the guy again. He's slightly different, just a little off kilter, right? So he's facing him head on, then he's maybe just a little bit angled.
Oh my God, that's so upsetting.
And before we get into the end, I just want to bring up one point about when they're in the treehouse at the very end. The mother and the grandmother's bodies, both been beheaded, are praying to the altar of Paimon, right? The mother, Annie, is on, what do you call it, stage right. So when the camera's facing, she's on the right of your screen. The grandmother's really decomposed body's on the left. But when Peter's gone around and he now looks at them in front, they reverse positions. So in both cases, the guy standing there looking at him and with the bodies, it could be continuity didn't do their job and these bodies and that dude in the corner aren't standing exactly or squatting exactly as they should have been. I like to think that was deliberate. Because we're now in teleporting times with Annie, especially, when she was alive at least, possessed though she was, but alive, that maybe the bodies change position because that's what happens in this kind of world. This is a world where there are demons.
And maybe it was done intentionally that you're not really meant to notice it, but it's just going to be one of those things that cues you to feel strange about the scene,
yeah.
To leave you feeling that much more unsettled. And the house itself seems to have a really strange geography. You can never really gauge where one room leads to another. You never get a really mapped out sense of how the house works. It's all kind of meant to be a little bit confusing and maybe a little bit dreamlike. And it is all meant to have a sense of artifice. That was something that Ari Aster said that he intentionally injected into the film. He cited being inspired by the film The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. I've seen that movie, but it was like 15 years ago, and it's another very dark film that is full of artifice.
Not a horror film, though, as he points out.
Yeah.
But gets under your skin.
Yeah. So it could be something that he injected into the film intentionally just to subliminally confuse viewers and just add to the weirdness of it all, because it's so weird by the end. And on the note of the naked, smiling man, we don't know how long we've been in the house. While he was sleeping, that's probably when they got let in. But there's also indications that they've been watching for weeks, maybe longer,
years.
Probably longer. There is a shot early on in the film when Peter is smoking pot in his bedroom and he's blowing it out the window. And then there's a shot from outside the house. And you don't see a person, but what you see is somebody's breath in the cold.
Yeah.
He's blowing out smoke and then there's cold breath.
Stop tainting Paimon's body! Future body!
But they're watching, and the whole film has this voyeuristic look to it. He built all the sets on the soundstage so that they could take walls out. Also to mimic the dollhouse motif to imply that they're being watched. We are very much omnipotent viewers, and there is an omnipotent force that is watching them and controlling everything they do.
So the movie is shot in Utah and set in Utah, which is a very interesting place to set a film. Not a lot of movies have been set in Utah or shot there, but it's also fitting because that's a very oppressed state. With the Mormonism that goes on there. You're not supposed to drink coffee. You're not supposed to eat chocolate or certainly not drink booze like we're doing right now. And then after the credit at the very beginning of the film that talks about Ellen, the grandmother's death, it opens on the treehouse. That's the very first shot we see. And then the camera goes through, and it's just a bit of a trick shot where it looks like the dollhouses that Annie creates, her miniatures. But then it ends up being that it's actually Alex Wolff and Gabriel Byrne, Peter and Steve, on a set. I'm sure there's some kind of interesting dissolve where they went from the dollhouse thing to the actual set. The very last shot for the credits shows them all bowing to Peter Payman as their new king. But did you notice it's in the treehouse, but it's the dollhouse motif?
Yeah, it's like cut in half and the camera is so far away.
And surrounded by black. It's not surrounded by trees and what's out there in the Utah wilderness, because this house is very cut off, but they're still surrounded by woods and things. Had they shown that, that'd be one thing. But they're ending by showing this collage type thing, this dollhouse that maybe Payman through Peter created, or maybe it's just playing off of what we've seen through the whole film with Annie making these dollhouses. It's a very artistic film in the first place. The mother and the daughter are both artists. Annie makes the dollhouses. And Charlie is a drawer.
And she makes her own weird outsider art sculptures that are actually like a bizarro version of the work that Annie does.
And the first time we see Charlie, she's asleep in the treehouse. And that's where her head ends up. Because she's the top of the Payman statue. I didn't really realize that's supposed to be her head. But they talk about that somewhere. Maybe it was the Dan and Roth review, but I read that somewhere.
Oh, I realized that's her head.
Well, I thought it just could have been some kind of paper mache thing, which is probably what it really was for the movie. But I thought maybe that's what it's supposed to be for the scene, too. But they talk about how that's the actual head, which earlier in the movie we see a little of the payoff, too. Because we don't see what happens when her head gets cut off. Well, we do, but we don't see it as explicitly as maybe some movies would have shown. We don't see the headless body ever. We see reactions to it. After the scene is over, they just cut to the shot of the head in the road covered in ants. And it's almost like this, oh, now you're showing it to us. Holy fuck, you're trying to scare us in some kind of weird way or unsettle us. And my question for that is, why would nobody have collected that head? It's daylight. You'd think somebody would have driven by there, or somebody from the cult would have driven by there to collect that head. And of course they had to at some point, because they have the head. But somebody, whether they're part of the cult or not, should have seen that. But that's one of those movie things of, well, maybe this is where it has to go for the movie. It's a Hitchcock thing, I guess. One thing I didn't notice before, somebody pointed out that there is the logo, the cult thing,
on the symbol.
That exact telephone pole that Charlie's head hits.
The idea is that the whole thing was arranged. It was set up by the cult. It was set up by Payman.
So specifically, though, that there's a dog in the way. And, of course, their dog later on seems to be dead at the very end of the film.
It's not a dog. It's a deer.
Was it a deer?
It's dead already. Yeah, so somebody could have easily...
But an animal seems to have been planted there.
But they knew exactly when they would have to plant that animal there.
Yeah, we're looking at Hitchcock stuff here, which is, just go with it. It has to be that way.
It's the toughest thing to wrap your head around. It definitely is one of the clumsier parts of the script, I would say. That and kind of the last 10 minutes are maybe where it just veers from perfection. Those are the things where, yeah, I can kind of understand people's criticisms of that scene playing out. It's hard to imagine the whole film making sense without believing that they could have pulled that off, and it's specifically as it was. The reason I accept it is because I figured that Payman is in Charlie. Charlie is Payman. Ari Aster has said that Charlie was possessed from birth. There's never been a Charlie. Probably the reason she's so bloody weird is that she's not really her. She's a demon that's been possessing her. So she could definitely be behind it. She could leave her EpiPen at home. She could eat the nuts on purpose. She could stick her head out the window at the right time.
She could be faking the attack.
Sure.
Dan and Roth point out that at some point in the movie, I didn't notice this, she's eating nuts. I think it's when she's doing her art and she's casually eating nuts.
Really?
So if they're right, that means it's all a lie anyway. Why does Annie insist Charlie go to that party in the first place with her older brother, who's at least 3 or 4 years older than she is? Charlie is weird to begin with, and she's not in this social class. Her brother seems to be fitting with people. Charlie fits in with no one. Is Annie possessed with Payman? We know she is at the end of the film. Maybe she is at different points in the film. Why is she so insistent? Doesn't make a lot of sense. She wants her daughter to be more a part of things, but why now, and why so?
I don't think it's because she wants Charlie to be social. Toni Collette's performance is so good. It's so layered. I paid extra close attention to this scene. She just seems to me in that moment like somebody who's annoyed with Peter. She's not a bad person, but she doesn't really know how to be a good person, and she gives into her weaker moments a lot in this film, and I think this is a moment where she's just annoyed with Peter because she knows he's lying to her about this party having drinking. She doesn't want to deal with him, so I think she's just being petty and saying, oh yeah, you can go to this party, take your sister, because he says it's just a school barbecue. You could argue she doesn't know it's a party, but I think she knows.
She's not casual about it, though. She is pretty insistent.
Charlie doesn't want to go,
mm-hmm.
but Charlie, as Paimon, does want to go. Paimon also could have been somehow influencing Annie. We know something is influencing Annie. Yeah. We don't know if it's the cult using their incantations and all their various machinations for controlling things. And a lot of people are like, how could all of these things have gone right? Well, one of the things that makes it a little easier to accept is that the film also shows the cult trying things and failing at them.
And maybe they failed for years before this.
Yes, exactly.
Charlie is a young teenager. Peter's a little bit older. He's the one they want. Maybe they tried this when he was 5 or when he was 8 or when he was 10. And now he's 17 or something. So now the time is right. And if this had failed, they could have tried again when he was 19 or 20.
Yeah. So this is just the attempt that they made that everything worked out. You see them try to lure Annie to the seance through mail. She ignores it.
That's got to be Joan doing that.
Yeah, of course it is. But then when Joan fails at that, what does she do? She waits in a parking lot for her to come out, and then she's pushy.
It's a meet cute.
And Dowd as Joan. Just the way she's touching her. I think they talk about this in the making of.
They do.
Yeah. Her physical performance of how she's constantly just crossing boundaries a little bit. But you have Annie, who we know is a person who was brought up by a terrible mother.
Probably never got hugged.
Well, beyond that, her mother is a monster. We don't need to know the details of Annie's upbringing to know that she had a bad upbringing because she was raised by a mother who sold her family to a demon-worshipping cult.
She says that she was not even my mom in the end. I think that's during one of those group sessions, right? So, yeah, her mother was sick, and it even says in the obituary at the very beginning of the film that she was sick. But was she also possessed by this demon the whole time, or a lot of the time at least? Or is that really the same thing?
Well, we learn about Annie's family. They each have their own unique kind of mental illness. So her father suffered from acute depression and starved himself to death.
And the question that Dan and Roth pointed out, stealing from them again, did he maybe have the demon in him and starved himself to kill himself because he had enough? He couldn't get rid of it, so I'll kill myself and then I'll be rid of it.
Well, we can be pretty sure that suicide was the way out for her brother.
Because her mother, Ellen, was trying to put the demon inside of him.
She says, oh, my brother killed himself because my mother was trying to put people inside of him. I think she says he's schizophrenic. He wasn't schizophrenic, he was right. Right? She says her mother had dementia, but also DID, which is dissociative...
Identity disorder,
which is like multiple personalities. Ironically, a character that Toni Collette famously played was Tara in United States of Tara, who was a person with dissociative identity disorder. But maybe she was also possessed.
Even just sometimes, because Paimon is sometimes inside of people, including Annie through this film, and at the end, Peter. And he's not always seemingly inside of Charlie. We see the light thing flit around Charlie's room at one point. So
yeah,
that says that at that moment, Charlie's Charlie.
I love the moment when Charlie, as a disembodied spirit, possesses Annie when they're doing the seance. One of the best touches. I don't know if this has been done in another movie before because it gave me insane chills. And that is when Charlie possesses Annie. And I guess we have to assume this is actually just Charlie's spirit and not necessarily Paimon. Unless Paimon gets so attached to the people that he possesses that he really would feel like he's Charlie.
I think it's one and the same at that point.
Yeah, and then Joan calls Peter Charlie at the end after Paimon has possessed Peter. So
we found you a more perfect. We got rid of the imperfect body. Or vessel, and now we have a perfect vessel.
She
Charlie.
Says Charlie. So when Charlie possesses Annie, her response, once she gets in a body, she sees her father, she sees her brother, and she starts panicking. She says, where's mommy? Where's mom? And she's freaking out. Of course, she can't see her mom because she is her mom. What an incredible and traumatizing touch to put into what could otherwise have been not a paint-by-numbers seance scene, but something that we've seen a lot of times before in a lot of movies.
Yep.
I don't feel like I've ever seen that before.
I like how, too, that the girl's name is Charlie. Now, I guess that's probably a short form of Charlotte, but that's still a man's name, generally.
Grandma wished she was a man.
And this is a movie where women serve men. So Charlie's no good. Peter's the vessel they really want. Although Ellen and Joan are sort of in charge. Ellen seemed to be all through her life, maybe not when she got sick towards the end, but Joan certainly is now. She's the one that speaks to Peter / Paimon / Charlie at the very end. No one else does. They all say, hey, oh, Paimon, but no one else really speaks towards the end of the film, other than Joan. So women can be top lieutenants of this guy, but this guy is all about the dudes, except for Steve. Because Gabriel Byrne, maybe the biggest name in the cast, maybe even bigger than Toni Collette, certainly as big as Toni Collette. Fine performance, he's not bad in the movie at all. The character means nothing, certainly to Payman.
Such a pawn.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Payman's so man-centric, this movie would really fail. Well, actually, it doesn't fail the Me Too test. I'm trying to be funny here, actually. It doesn't fail the Me Too test at all. You've got a woman lead who's got most of the scene.
You mean the Bechdel test?
The point being that it's actually a very woman-centric movie, but a character that's all about dudes is what I'm trying to get at here. I like the touch, though, that the husband is not the savior. He doesn't fix everything. And he's a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. They talk in the making of that he would have been any psychiatrist at one point. This woman, as a girl, probably needed a psychiatrist all along with her crazy mother. Then certainly she got older. And her daughter would have needed one, too, although her daughter never had one. Then she died so young from the telephone pole thing. Steve has seen some shit with this family. And he can't control much of it. They're so disconnected. Maybe the most important scene in the whole film, actually, is at dinner.
Oh, the best scene.
When Toni Collette freaks out, maybe the clincher for the Oscar, she won't get nominated probably at all, which is a shame. Again, Dan and Roth, Dan especially, have been pimping this out for a long time. They're right. She should be nominated. She probably should win. Lady Gaga didn't win the Golden Globe. It was Glenn Close. And Olivia Colman won the Comedy Globe. So they'll probably both be nominated, those two. And maybe one of them will win. Collette won't even be at the show, though. And if I were to pick, of all the actresses I've seen this year, and I haven't seen every performance yet. I haven't actually seen a lot of the Zeitgeisty movies. I've seen about 90-some-odd movies at this point. But what I've seen, Toni Collette should win it in a walk. And there have been some great performances.
Yeah.
But during the dinner scene, when all this stuff is going on, if they as a family in that moment, the three remaining family members, had connected and fixed the problem, do they maybe beat Payman? Because the reason why Payman can do the things that it can do is this disconnected, problematic family. It's like The Shining. In the book, more so The Shining than the movie, had they been able to go to Jack when he thought he was drunk, because he wasn't really, he was imagining it. Danny talks at one point, he should go down and help his dad, and he tries to, but one of the ghosts stops him from doing it. Had they been able to fix that, maybe they could get by as a family and they'd stop seeing these crazy things in that hotel.
And the fact that, like, Mom and Danny do stick together is the reason why they get out alive.
Right. So the same thing in Hereditary. If they could have maybe tried to bond in that moment rather than push each other further away.
What does she say? And what a waste! If at least this tragedy could have brought us together! But it didn't. It drives them apart, but it's her driving them apart. This is where I talk about Alex Wolff as a performer. His performance of this numbness and this grief and this shock, trying to get through one day at a time while his mother clearly has this increasing contempt for him. You want somebody to reach out to him so badly and to successfully give him some catharsis. Gabriel Byrne tries, but you're right, he's kind of
useless. He sort of tries.
Why doesn't the demon ever possess him? Well, because he hasn't inherited whatever is so special about this family. Like, it's hereditary that the demon favors them.
He's the outsider.
Yeah, he's the outsider. He doesn't have this gene, whatever it is. The whole movie is a metaphor for how we inherit poor health, poor mental health, but
mental
also
illness, yeah.
Trauma. The trauma of generations. Something terrible that happens to your mother will come out in our lives. Or your grandparents, people maybe that you never even met, traumas that they experience will influence even us because of the chain of one parent after another carrying on with these bad patterns. And obviously Annie cannot get past it. She can't recover from her bad upbringing enough to come through for her child, to keep her family together. Her marriage seems to have some warmth, but God, it's strange. I mean, it's strange to begin with just to look at. He's 22 years older than her, and Byrne is. And of course, we learn their dynamic is built on the assumption that he was once her psychiatrist, according to Ari Aster, that after he stopped treating her, he started seeing her afterwards. Well, that's a pretty effed up dynamic for people to have. And you know what's funny is he used to play psychiatrists also in the show In Treatment on
and
HBO.
And Alex Wolff was his son.
And Alex Wolff was his son. Yeah.
So they're used to each other. They worked with each other before. And that maybe informs their performances. They don't have a lot of screen time together. No two characters really do. Annie has a lot of time with everybody. She's certainly, by far, Toni Collette has the most screen time with any one person. She has some time with Charlie. She has some time with her husband, some time with Peter, some time with Joan. We never actually see Ellen on screen. We only see pictures, and we see what's supposed to be her dead body a few different times. I couldn't even find a screen credit for who plays that woman, because somebody had to actually be there for the pictures. But I don't know who that was. Maybe I'll find it later on, and I'll post it on the website if I do.
But yeah, the family is very alienated from each other. They each have their own room, even, that they occupy in the house, like you would a dollhouse. They don't really spend a lot of time with one another.
A little bit more about the grandmother. The woman ruined her own family, meaning her husband and her son, and then her daughter wasn't ruined until the storyline, but still wasn't healthy for probably most of her life. She's 35, 40, whatever years old, maybe 45 years old, and most of that was not easy, obviously. But then she also ruins Annie's family. first Charlie from birth, or at the very least from very young, insisting on breastfeeding her. How do you do that as an older woman, getting breast milk?
You get help from a demon.
And all for riches? It seems to be that's why she's doing it.
Riches in hell? Because she's dead. When did she enjoy these riches?
You wonder, too, if someone like her, or if it happens to will happen to Joan at some point, when they shuffle up this mortal coil, will they say, why didn't you prevent me from dying at 72? Because I think that's what it says in the beginning, that Ellen was 72, not that old, and she's serving this greater purpose, so why didn't Paimon somehow find a way to keep her alive longer? I bet she had that thought in her head, but then she wasn't herself at the end, because she had a earthbound illness, and she's thinking she's doing something grander than that.
Or did she have an earthbound illness? They don't say what actually killed her. They say she had dementia. She was hardly herself at the end.
I like the notion that it really was that, because that's part of what is going on here. I don't believe any of this kind of stuff, this demonic shit, this God and Satan and all this kind of stuff. Paimon's supposed to be one of the 9 demons of hell. They've said 8. That at the very end. I heard 9.
I heard 8.
Well, anyway, we'll look it up later on, I guess. A demon of hell regardless, in any case. All that stuff is ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. But I love the fact that it's a betrayal. There had to be something inside of Ellen that thought, I will be immortal, or I'll live on into something else. People always believe that. So many people at least do. Muslim religion, Christian religion, probably all the religions believe they're going to go into something better in whatever the afterlife is. Doesn't have to be heaven, but whatever your afterlife is.
A reward of some kind.
And maybe there is. None of us fucking know. That's one of the things that's so absurd about things like a pope. You're more intelligent than I am about what the afterlife really is. But I love that notion that this woman, if she's in her mind at all, is probably feeling like, but I'm one of your most important, maybe the most important lieutenant you have, and I'm not going to live. Why aren't you saving me somehow? You have supernatural powers, which we know because towards the end of the movie, we see Annie especially doing things that are not human. I've talked before, and you've agreed with me a lot of this, or you've had your own theories about what really goes on in movies like Taxi Driver, Vertigo, many others. Are we watching what's really happening, or are these people just pretending something? It's a dream, it's a thought, it's something psychotic inside of them. This movie seems to be speculating that these things really are happening.
But there's parts where they blur the line. I'm thinking specifically of the dream sequences that happen where Annie dreams that she sees Peter's body covered in ants and then it's covered in paint thinner and she's going to burn them up. And of course, that's a dream. But then there's another scene where Peter dreams that he sees Charlie in the corner and then that somebody's pulling on his head and he's freaking out. These dreams share so many themes. Like, are they happening? Are they coming from a real place?
Well, dreams are dreams, though. And you're right, because it could be his dream. It definitely is hers. We see her do the classic movie, sit up in bed. And as the Simpsons point out, nobody ever sits up in bed like that. Maybe you start yourself awake, that kind of moment. But that is a dream. That's also where she admits, I never wanted to be your mother. Mm-hmm. That's part of the whole Ellen thing, too. Her own mother betrayed her daughter by making her have a family, by pressuring her to do something she never wanted to do. You never wanted to be a mother either, but at least you weren't pressured into it by your parents.
No, my parents did.
Maybe they're disappointed.
Maybe I should take it personally. My parents never pressured me.
Maybe they were disappointed you never had any kids. Your dad more so than your mom from what I've ever seen. But they never told you or never forced you to do it. Obviously not like this anyway. But it just gives you that whole ground and reality element with this movie. That it's always about the family in the end. The specific family. It could be about the world in general. But this is about a very specific group of people. 5, effectively. We hear about Annie's brother and her father. But they're never really part of the story. We never see the grandmother on screen. But she's definitely a part of the story. Well, we do see her. But she's never actually in the movie. Never has any dialogue. But she is definitely a part of the film. So it's the 4 main family members. The Grahams. And then her mother. So it's so much about that. Just like The Shining is so much about that family. And that's where the breakdown occurs. I think that's why this movie works, because you do have your jump scares. You do have your weird moments. You have the moments where Annie twice is up by the ceiling. And unless you're, well, you don't have to be that sharp a viewer, actually. You can see her there. Some people probably didn't. Not everyone's as observant as everyone else. When I watched the scene now twice, once with you and once putting it back in the Blu-ray again today, and the dude in the doorway, when I saw it on YouTube, it looked like it was darker. I think it's actually too bright in the Blu-ray. You can absolutely see him. It almost should be that you can't quite make out what you're seeing. But with Annie, even in the Blu-ray, it's not absolutely clear what you're seeing. Yes, you shouldn't miss that she's up on the corners of these two rooms, but it isn't blatantly obvious either. And they only go for that one jump scare when she's in the corner, which means she's teleported. We've already seen it happen now. First, she scuttles across, and in watching this again, when she leaves his bedroom, you know what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't seem to be touching anything. I thought maybe she was doing that against the side of the wall.
She's moving her limbs, but she doesn't seem to be touching the
ceiling. Right. It's like she's swimming or something like that. You don't hear anything either. And then she goes from being up in the corner of the living room to being in that other corner opposite him and runs at him. And that's the one jump scare in the whole movie. But then the 2 bigger sci-fi kind of things she does One is when she just teleports inside of the attic when he's locked it. There are other people in there, by the way, more naked people. They could have been there already, fine. But she wasn't. And then suddenly she is. And one of the great moments in the whole film is when you hear her banging on the floor of the attic when Peter's up there. When I watched it on YouTube the second time, before we saw the movie together, but I'd seen the movie in the theater last year, I hadn't remembered this all that specifically, but just the notion that you're hearing this banging, but she can't reach that. That's about maybe 10 feet in the air. And as soon as I had that thought, they cut and see that she's supernaturally hanging there, banging her own head. What a great visual. That will stay with me for a very long time. Great moment. But then, of course, she's cutting off her own head. A lot of beheadings in this movie. We'll get back to the ending a second, actually. We talk about beheadings. We got to get back to the telephone pole thing because that's the moment that I remember from this movie maybe more than anything else. When I saw it in the theater, I didn't know anything about this movie. I don't think I'd really heard even what it was about. Maybe just that, the basic storyline, the premise and everything. I didn't know anything about killing off the kid, the daughter, the whatever she is, 13 years old kid.
The marketing very strongly promoted her as one of the main characters.
So she's dead in the first
very effective to me.
Half hour, 40 minutes or something like that. Yeah. And that way, I've never seen that before, but even more powerfully is the way that Alex Wolff plays. We never see her body, like I said. He stops. There's a long time. Maybe it's a little too long. Although it is real. He thinks about it. He looks in the rear view. He sees that. We never get a cutaway, very smartly. Drives home. Lets his mother see it. What is going on? Why does he do that?
He's in shock. He's in terrible shock. Okay, so I have a story that I heard from a friend of mine that I went to college with. And she confessed to me that when she was in high school in her senior year, she was in a terrible car accident with three of her friends. There were four of them in the car. And the car rolled. When it was all over, she was the only one in the car who was conscious. She didn't know if they were alive or dead. She took a seatbelt off, got out of the car, walked home, went to bed, and was like, I just pretended it never happened. She was so horrified by what she saw, and she was in such deep shock that she just thought she could convince herself it was a dream. And she felt terrible about reacting this way. She really beat herself up about it. But it's this pure expression of shock. This is not a story she was telling that I think she could have possibly been exaggerating, just like a confession she made when we were having a confessional moment. It was something she felt really guilty about. So I believe in that scene that he could have behaved that way. He's also a teenager. He's like 16 years old. And his performance of shock, he knows what's happened. He hears the silence in the back seat, and there's still this part of him that almost mumbles, are you okay? He doesn't say it. I heard it better in the theater, and he's saying something, and it's not even words, but it kind of has that same cadence as, are you okay? He goes to look at the rearview mirror, and then he's like, no, if I don't look, then it's not real.
I thought he did look, though.
He glances over, but do you make out what's happening?
No, but they don't show it to us. That's very smart. Ari Aster never really reveals to us.
And then he turns his head away because he can't stand to look at it. So he just drives home and pretends it was a dream. The movie does such a great job of putting you there, and you're so concerned about her getting to the hospital, and you're like, oh my gosh, she's going to die of anaphylactic shock, that the last thing you're expecting is for her to get decapitated. So then when it happens, we've all had moments in our life where we're like, this isn't happening. You just can't believe it. And it's that irreversible moment, too, that he's sitting there, terrified to look in the backseat, terrified to make the moment real, because he just wishes he could undo it, undo this undoable moment to cope with the trauma. I mean, even before anything bad happens, other than, I guess, his grandmother dying, he's clearly self-medicating with marijuana. He's a heavy pot user, and he continues to do so for the rest of the film, although it doesn't help him. You see him having panic attacks, and then, well, his freak out is because he's possessed by Paimon, but he's not really successfully medicating himself from that point on.
Okay, so maybe it's the shock thing, but I still feel like Paimon must know he's got his man, because Peter recovers from that trauma pretty quickly and handles it very calmly and coolly.
You know, a reasonably good question could be, why didn't Paimon simply possess him right in that moment? Because I don't think he's going to get lower. Him jumping out the window was one thing, but at least that was a moment that he chose. He felt remotely in control, trying to get away and save his own life. Whereas in that moment when his sister just got decapitated, you think that's a person that probably would want to give up his life and would rather he were dead or as good as dead than carry on with the rest of his life. But, you know, then there'd be no movie.
And that's the answer, obviously. The demon needs him, or probably anyone, any vessel, to be at their lowest moment. That may be it. When Peter jumps out the attic and lands face first, if he's not dead, he's at least badly hurt if he's just human. And maybe the suggestion is that he does die, and you do see the little light happen on his body, so clearly he's possessed. And maybe he's resurrected in a literal sense. They do have the Antichrist pose, the hand on the statue thing they've created is pointing down. It's supposed to be a mockery of the way Jesus has that hand up thing with the two fingers, almost like, I'm bless you. But he, by any right, should be more badly hurt than he really was. He's already got a destroyed nose from bashing into the desk earlier that same day. Why is he okay? I guess because it's not him anymore. Yet, ironically, he doesn't seem to be happy about it the way that Paimon should be. We see him look into the reflection at school. The one time, I think, in the whole movie he ever smiles is not even real because it's a reflection that's not his actual reflection. He looks like he always does, but he sees himself. Hey, big grin on his face. Why isn't he Paimon right then at the very end when he goes into the attic and they anoint who he really is? He still seems like Peter. He's bewildered. The movie ends with a state of bewilderment. So what does Peter do now? He's still basically a kid. His family is dead. Brutally dead. His father was burned alive only about an hour before. His mother cut her own head off. His sister's only been dead for a little while. His grandmother was not long before that. Does he just go back to school? And then the other question becomes, what is Paimon's endgame with Peter? I guess you could say that about things like The Omen, too. What is Satan trying to do through Damien? I guess rule the world. And those sequels in The Omen actually do play off the notion that Satan's going to take over and destroy through financial means and political means by being a rich and powerful person and trying to be president in the United States. But I do wonder about, in a movie like this, what is the endgame, especially with someone who's so young and who now has nothing? How does he just live in that house? Is that supposed to be the notion? One of the things I noticed in watching the end scene again is that when he finds his father's burned body, it's slightly moved. It was more in the middle of the room when Steve lights on fire, but now it's pretty close to the fireplace. And in a position that almost seems unnatural, it's like he just toppled over. It looks like it's actually a stunt person on fire, or maybe it's just a visual effect, but the feet are moving. So you could just say that's post-production. Maybe that's what it was. But I also noticed that his actual, maybe say from the ankle up, is all that's on fire. The feet aren't. So is somehow Paimon making a fire happen? Well, obviously he does, because Steve is not lit on fire by any practical normal means. But then he's down on the ground, seemingly had been fully engulfed in flames, and yet that room never caught on fire. It's wood floor. You could see the carpet's been pulled aside. Is it all just supernatural stuff? And this movie does deal in blatant supernatural activity, just like The Shining eventually makes it pretty clear. This is really happening to these people. Although maybe not, because Wendy sees stuff in The Shining. She seems to have The Shining too. She sees the elevator of blood. No one else does. Danny does in his dream, but she sees it in quote-unquote reality. She sees the skeletons in the lobby. They all end up seeing things. Maybe none of it was ever there in any real sense, even in a ghost movie like The Shining. But this movie seems to be making it very clear that what we're seeing through the whole thing, if not all of it, then most of it, really did happen.
You have to assume that Paimon is enjoying all of this.
It's a trickster kind of spirit. King Paimon is a god of mischief. I think that says that in one of the books that Annie finds.
Yes.
So why not burn Steve alive? Because we don't need him anyway, so let's make him die horribly.
Yeah.
And when why she not
thinks,
fuck
this is funny. She's going to think this is going to set her on fire. This will be so funny.
Right.
It's going to be her husband instead.
And why not fuck with everybody in this family, except for the one I want, which is the son. And it's also interesting that he is the first character of this family we see on screen. Maybe tied with Gabriel Byrne, because Byrne comes in the room when we first realize that that panning shot ends up being an actual bedroom. But it's his bedroom, so effectively, it's Peter we first see on screen, and he's the last one we see on screen, well, with the other people bound to him, but he's the last person we see on screen that we ever really cared about. So the story was always about him, and we never really knew that. And like I said, Toni Collette is on screen more than anyone else in the movie in total, and certainly deserves a Best Actress nomination for all kinds of reasons, one of them being that this is truly her movie, but the irony is that the whole plotline is not for her at all. It's for her son, and always was, or at least was for many years.
Yeah, you really don't put it together until the end of the film, the first time I saw it. It was one of those movies that you see it, and then you have to think about it and make sense of it. Well, first I had to recover from it. I remember I saw it in the theater alone, and then I was biking home, and it was dark, and I was like, I can't cope with this right now. I was so traumatized by the movie, but in the best way. After I recover from the trauma of it all, starting to piece together, oh, so this means this. Oh, so Charlie was probably possessed the whole time. Oh my God, it was about Peter right from the beginning. And Peter, like you said, it's the first character that we technically see in the film. He's in bed, but that's kind of a hint. This whole movie is all about him. And then what's the first thing that happens? His dad comes because he's trying to wake him up and get his attention. The focus is on him in the very beginning of the film.
To go to a funeral for his grandmother who recently died, because she's why any of this is even happening to the four of them. It wouldn't have had it not been for her. We talk about the treehouse. It's a major part of the movie, which is also a bit of an infantilization. A treehouse is usually for kids. But we see all four of them in that room, including the grandmother, the dead body, all five of them in that treehouse at one time or another, including, of course, the people at the very end, but of our family members, all five of them are in that treehouse at one time or another. Briefly, Stephen pokes his head in when he sees Charlie laying there, saying about how cold it was last night. And then later, Annie, after Charlie's dead, sleeps there more than once. We see the red heaters. That sets it up, so at the very end, we see the red thing, and it plays off that. It's not just out of nowhere that it's this treehouse that's lit red.
It's a great visual, too.
It's also a great visual. Yeah. But she cheats. I think that's one of the clever things about that, by taking space heaters out there, because Charlie didn't.
That's right.
But Annie's doing something that's also wrong. If you're going to sleep out there, then have the balls to be naked in the middle of the forest like my followers are, Annie. What are you doing? I'm taking space heaters up there. So Annie destroys those miniatures, the dollhouses she creates in the movie, in a fit of rage. I don't think she's supposed to be possessed by payment at that point. But that's an interesting touch because, like I said, the very last shot seems to be that somebody has created this diorama of Peter being bowed to as Paimon by all the people at the very end of the movie. The dollhouses are obviously a metaphor for a lack of control as well. The family are pawns in this game the whole time. Dolls and dollhouse have no control. People have said that Wes Anderson does diorama movies and just has dollhouses. This movie goes right into that. It literally makes it that, including playing off the notion that the opening shot is a dollhouse that becomes reality.
The dollhouse is a powerful metaphor. The Grants have no agency. They're being manipulated like dolls and manipulated by a sadistic force. Then there's nothing they can do about it but suffer. In the same way, none of us really have control, especially about what family we're born into. We don't have control over the genes that will determine whether we have illness or whether we are mentally ill as well. And we don't have control over any of the traumas that make up our prehistory, whether it be our parents or grandparents, or traumas that just happen to us that have nothing to do with our family. But yeah, we are really subject to the luck of our birth.
And happening to have a grandmother or mother who is selling her soul and her family's soul for riches. That's an interesting touch, because I keep mentioning The Shining, but in that movie, it's not about riches at all. It's just about
having a basic job. She's Queen Lee at the end. She's in hell. We can presume, if everything went as planned, and we have to presume that because the movie's telling us that this is real, they have the picture of her in the treehouse, that she's Queen Lee now, so she's presumably in hell, enjoying her reign, enjoying riches, whatever they may be, in hell, but they're not a pile of gold, like is illustrated in the book.
Oh, kind of like Pan's Labyrinth, then.
Yes.
Well, they all end up in their paradise, but it's an afterlife. It's not the life we know. It's not Earth.
Mm-hmm. That's her reward. That is one thing that doesn't make sense. It's riches to the Conjurer, but, well, the Conjurer's dead. So how can she enjoy her riches?
And apart from Steve, the family's back together. Charlie's head is in that treehouse. Annie and Ellen are both there. Peter's there. The family's back together. And what a scene. I guess Peter won't call the cops, because why would he? Peter as Paimon won't call the cops.
Somebody's going to find out that they're all dead, though.
They'd probably hide all the evidence. Like I said, the room didn't burn down like it probably should have when Steve was lit on fire. The family seance that takes place, by the way, Steve burns in that same room, and that's where Annie is taken over. Those great visuals of her face just terrified. And in the moment when Steve burns, first she has one of those looks, and then because Paimon, the little light thing is over her, she goes, boop. She goes from, to
numb.
And then from that point on,
like dead face.
Annie's gone. Annie is literally living, but now she's Paimon. She's up in the ceiling of Peter's bedroom. Then she's up in the ceiling of the living room. She chases after him, bangs her head on the cellar door, whatever. And the next time we see her, she's cutting her own head off. Yeah, okay, act door. And then cutting her own head off. From that point on, whatever Annie ever was.
She doesn't speak, does she?
No, there's no more dialogue. Mm. From that point on, Annie's dead, because as soon as Paimon does that kind of moment, Annie's gone. So husband and wife effectively both die in a matter of seconds in that exact same room.
One of my favorite points that Screen Junkies made in that review that you talked about is that part of the reason why things can get as haywire as they do in the movie is because Annie's trauma and her bad upbringing have made her incapable of seeing warning signs. And that's a true thing, that when you've been the victim of trauma, of violence, of any kind of betrayal, especially when you're a kid, one of the symptoms of that throughout your entire life is this inability to identify danger. So you wouldn't see the signs that Joan is off, or that your kid's behavior is actually strange, or even that it's a bad idea to send your 13-year-old to what you suspect is a house party with drinking. Your brain truly doesn't identify those things the way it ought to. Another legacy of her hereditary trauma.
Yeah, and there's also the speculation we've already made about whether or not Paimon actually made her feel this way. It's never actually said. Maybe Annie isn't really that bright to begin with. I'm not saying she's stupid, but we always assume characters in movies that we care about have to be smart. Unless they blatantly are, like Forrest Gump or the guy in Sling Blade, who aren't mentally all there.
Well, we know she's very talented. Those miniatures really are something. Yeah, I suppose so.
Those miniatures are very good, and there's that ghoulish touch where she actually recreates the beheading of her daughter with a telephone pole. That's fucked up. Millie Shapiro, by the way, who plays Charlie, is 13 years old, or was when they shot the movie. This is her only film so far. When you look online, there's nothing else in the hopper for her. Ari Aster said she would do one of these scenes because she is really good, like they all are in this movie. And as soon as he'd say cut, she'd be, hey, how's it going, guys? Let's talk about whatever she was into. It was not about, all right, I'm a character actor and I'm still haunted. No, this little girl could do the disconnect of, I'm possessed to, hey, let's talk about fun stuff.
When people talk about how casting agents deserve to have an Oscar category, well, this film is a great case for that because it is made by its cast. These five actors who are the main parts are all so incredible, and they bring so much to the film. If they had not found Millie Shapiro, who is beyond perfect, winning the jackpot of finding an actress who's both that, as you say, self-possessed, such an excellent actress, but able as a young teenager to perform that level of creepiness, and to look weird. She is a weird-looking girl.
They're not the best-looking family to begin with. None of these people are Hollywood gorgeous.
Something strange about her face. I actually kept waiting in the film for them to talk about how maybe she has some kind of condition or something. I looked up the actress. Mm. Maybe there's something with her. There's some kind of syndrome or something that she suffers from that makes her look odd, but it doesn't come up. What does come up is that before she was in this film, she already had a pretty great career going on Broadway. She has won an honorary Tony when she was 10 years old for playing Matilda on Broadway, and then she was in something else. I'm going to kick myself for forgetting it, but she was in another really big production as the lead.
So that's why she has no film credit. She's actually just making Broadway stuff, I guess, then.
She won an Emmy as well, or she was part of the team that won an Emmy for the cast recording. I want to say it was also for Matilda. So she can sing and dance, too, on top of all that. This girl is talented.
Anne Dowd has been around since the days at least of Philadelphia because she plays, I think, Tom Hanks' sister or sister-in-law. That's 25, 26 years ago. Maybe she's been around even longer than that. That movie that I didn't like that much, Compliance, she's the best thing in that. And of course, she's Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale.
Aunt Lydia is always going to be her defining role.
Probably so, but this is one hell of a last couple of years for her on that TV show and in this movie. And Alex Wolff was in Patriot's Day as one of the bombers. I think is it Tsarnaev in the Boston bombing, the marathon? And then he's the young Rock in Jumanji. He's the one that actually is Rock's in the movie way more than he is, but he's the one the Rock becomes.
They talked in the making of about how he's a really method actor. He goes full Daniel Day-Lewis and wouldn't break character the entire time they were shooting the film, to the point where Ari Aster said that on the last day of shooting, after he shot his last scene, he then went around and introduced himself to everybody as Alex. He could now embody his real self again. But all I could think when he was telling the story is, did you do that on Jumanji? Were you so deep in method on Jumanji?
He's not in that one very much, though. So maybe
no.
Easier to do that. So Ari Aster, who wrote and directed this is his debut. What a first movie. He's made a few shorts. Midsommar or Midsommar, it's Mid, S-O-M-M-A-R, is due in August of this year. I don't know if any of these actors are actually in it. It's too bad. He should use some of the same cast members. This was a quick shoot. Hereditary was. He prefers practical effects like Christopher Nolan, so kudos to him for doing that. And that makes it more impressive that it was a quick shoot when you're using practical effects. And he likes things to be big and loud, including the score. It's a good score by Colin Stetson, who's pretty new to movie score making. He's got a handful of credits, but there's a ton of music in this movie. It's more than you'll hear in probably most movies. I guess he's a saxophonist. That's what he's best known for.
He said he's an experiment.
You look at his credits and he's been involved in movies, but not as an actual composer that much until now. It may be too much, it may be way over the top, and I haven't seen First Man, so I don't know how the score was in that movie, but if I had to vote between those two and maybe any other score from this past year, I'd go with this one.
I really like it as a score hater. I mean, most of it is really droney and this weird noise in the background.
Like in The Shining. Ominous.
Yes, like The Shining. By the time it really starts getting bombastic is when you're so caught up that it belongs there. You don't notice it. It doesn't impose itself on you, and to me, that is a great score.
At the very end, when Peter has his coronation, it's some kind of classical theme, too. So it is like The Shining, using pre-existing classical music in addition to stuff written by somebody from today. Aster finds a good way to use exposition, too. People do talk about the death of a loved one. So she's giving us exposition. Annie is in the therapy scene. She's able to tell us things about her mother, just like in the eulogy. But it feels natural. It's not that, as my mother of many years, she felt, she didn't say anything like that.
Everybody talks about Toni Collette's moment at the dinner table, her outburst there, but this is also an absolutely phenomenal bit of performance, the way she tells the story. In some ways, she seems to be telling it with the cadence of someone who's told this story many times, but at other times, she just breaks and has a little, almost micro-emotional reaction to this thing or that, or the contempt in her voice when she says her mom got her claws into Charlie. And the naturalness of it. The overwhelming thing about Toni Collette is that she can be in these extreme situations and still come across as a tremendously natural actress.
It feels so real. It does not feel like she's putting on a performance. The best horror films that have been about real people have been like that. Maybe not The Shining so much. Those performances don't feel very real.
Yeah, but that movie's kind of supposed to be floating a little above reality. It has artifice.
But Sissy Spacek and Carrie feels very real. Not so much the mother. But Sissy Spacek does, I would say. And other recent movies, we're going to talk about those in a second. Well, let's talk about them now. The new era of horror. We covered The Witch and It Follows just last year in Horror Movie Month in October. Also Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. There are other ones I could talk about, but those four, The Witch, It Follows, Hill House, and Hereditary, are all about families mostly.
And that Babadook.
Oh, right. Of course, I'm going to talk about The Babadook as well. And The Exorcist, which is a long time ago. Even Rosemary's Baby. I guess every one of those are about families that are falling apart in one way or another, and they can't connect. And the horror is almost incidental.
And the ending is bad. In the end, the bad guy wins. We talked about this on It Follows, that this seems to be a defining feature on the movement of arty horror films that are coming out in the 20-teens. All these wonderful movies that have come out around the same time that have been beautiful, thematic, deep horror films with troubling themes that stay with you for a long time. All those movies that you just said, one of the big things they share in common, and Hereditary almost more than most, is the bad guy wins at the end. It is a bad ending.
You probably can't really fully analyze these movies unless you have 2 hours on these things, and we're not even taking that long for these podcasts because there's so much going on that's beyond the scares and even just beyond the family trauma that's portrayed. A24, who did this movie, by the way, are the horror people, it seems, because they also did The Witch and It Comes at Night. Of those three, It Comes at Night is the weakest one, and it's pretty good too, and also has a bleak ending where our heroes, our main characters at least, have failed. They're going to lose.
I'll repeat my theory that I said when we covered It Follows. I think part of the appeal of these movies in this time and place, and the reason why people are suddenly being drawn to movies with unhappy endings, is because I think we're living in a time when we're trying to brace ourselves and prepare ourselves for catastrophe.
Which was always true, but it feels more true the last 2+ years, doesn't it? So the movie's 2:0:0:1. Interesting aspect ratio. And we watched our brand new Blu-ray, which I bought, I think, the day we watched the movie. I went to Best Buy. And if it's going to be on Netflix in a month, I won't regret that. Because, as you say, we're voting with our money. This movie deserves to be bought, even in the $22 or so I paid for it.
And even if it was on Netflix tomorrow, it wouldn't be on Netflix forever. And I really anticipate wanting to see this movie over and over again throughout the years.
The cinematographer, I heard Astor say this name in the making of, and I forget now, but it was Pavel Pogorzelski, I think it's right. He's mostly done shorts, and he's working on, I'll call it Midsommar, with Astor, that'll come out later this year. Cinematography seemed pretty good to me. The editor.
Beautiful, yeah, okay, it's wonderful. Lots of original trick-looking shots.
Well, too. I guess the fact that they put Toni Collette, because she at one point in the living room, when they rack focus, she's up there. And not making it obvious that she, maybe it was just some kind of dummy that was up there in the bedroom, but not making it blatantly obvious there's something there, but still, you can see it. Maybe the Blu-ray's brighter than what was on YouTube. I feel like it might have been, because you see the dude in the corner seeming brighter than he was. But still, yeah, that's a very effective use of light. The outside light as well. They use that sensor light. That lights up the room just a little bit, and you see her just a little bit more when she's in his bedroom standing over him, or hovering over him.
I'm thinking of shots like when they're in the cemetery and the camera lowers itself into a grave. Another kind of dollhouse shot.
But the Blue Velvet-esque thing, actually.
So much depth. And this is something I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, that visually it's astounding, it's beautiful, every shot is nice to look at, but all these quote-unquote trick shots are serving the theme. They're not just there as a gimmick ever. They really do service the movie and just get us deeper and deeper into what's going on. And this is kind of a function of the editing as well, but certainly Ari Aster and the cinematographer had to be involved in this. And those are those transitions that they would make. Alex Wolff is in his bedroom in a certain position sitting, and then it cuts to him in the classroom, and he's in the exact same position, but it just seems like this flawless cut, as if we don't even know how he got there, and it's a trick shot, but it's so effective. Even, like, the editing trick of them going from night to day all the time. Mm,
there's no side shot that's like that.
Someone flipped a light switch on way you would if you had a dollhouse in a room. It's another trick of, look, this isn't the natural world.
Yeah, you do see the house at one point in a faraway shot in daytime, and then there's a cut, and it's just in dark. The editors, by the way, Lucian Johnston and Jennifer Lame, or Lame, probably Lame, it's spelled like the word lame. Johnston was an assistant on a lot of movies before this. This is his first actual main cutting job, and Lame worked on Manchester by the Sea. So I guess you think, even though this movie is over 2 hours long, it's really well cut. I do.
Oh, yeah. The tension. This is a movie where you can really point out the times when somebody else would have cut when they just stay on the shot. The most obvious example would be when Peter's in the car right after Charlie's been beheaded, and we just have to sit and watch him and look at him. It takes so long to get there in a moment that you think should be blasting with emotion. It suddenly becomes super quiet, and we're just stuck there in this moment with him. There's so many times that we are just forced to live with a moment until it's uncomfortable, and that is all about editing. It's all about that choice. A lot of people, if they didn't have as much experience, would be really tempted to just end on what feels like the proper pacing, the proper beat that a TV show would end at, or a lot of movies, or a Marvel film would. That happened, all right, you know all the information, let's carry on to the next scene. No.
You're gonna stay with this.
You gotta watch this.
When he wakes up in his bed in the climax and then goes to the living room, and we've discussed all that happens there, that takes maybe a little bit too long, but even if you cut that down, it'll only be a matter of seconds. You're not going to save that much in that sequence. I don't know if it would really help it, because maybe the point's supposed to be, let's unsettle the audience. What's in that house now? We've seen that they've infiltrated the house by putting the grandmother's body up there. We don't know what we're about to see. I'm not trying to say that if you see this movie for the first time, or if you don't know it that well, you're going to know that the dude's in the doorway, and you're going to know that people are in the attic, and there's all kinds of people outside, and in the treehouse. There's a lot of people in this cult. Not hundreds, but definitely seems like dozens. But they've been in the house before, and the fact that you should know that as he's wandering through, maybe that's the point. Like I said, probably the only jump scare is the mother running at him from the corner of the living room. Let's pretend that's going to happen to you. Let's make you think that's going to happen. Because we've just seen the mother scuttling across his bedroom. She's not normal anymore, so it's got to happen. And it doesn't really for a long time, and it's really smart. You saw this movie with more people than I did, because you saw an evening show. I saw an afternoon show. I don't remember the audience I saw with being any kind of a factor, but you said that they were doing the clucking thing that Charlie does.
Oh,
but yeah. The bigger question I want to ask you is, did you hear that thing? Because Dan and Roth talk about this in the review, where people do the, oh my God.
Yes, big time.
You heard that?
Yeah. The whole audience was slowly reacting one at a time. That scene happens and she's in the corner, and I think I spotted her right away, and then I could hear people, and they go, oh. But then you could hear the people who were like, what? You know, because they would start looking for it. The late reactors were somehow the biggest reactors, but there was definitely reaction.
Well, we talked about The Babadook, The Exorcist, The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, The Witch, It Follows, Haunting of Hill House, all with connections to this movie one way or another about family, being a mother sucking, you can't connect with your kids, all these kind of things, families fracturing, disconnection. We've reviewed The Babadook, we reviewed The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, The Witch, and It Follows, all online. I'll include links to all of those. So if you haven't heard those podcasts before, you should, because every one of those movies have depth that you wouldn't have expected the first time you see them, and they all, I think, improve with age, and this one certainly does too.
They are all a gift to movie lovers, particularly if you like your shit dark.
And horror movies. It's quite a golden age at this point. Okay, long podcast here. Our first one back after a week off. And our last one in the month of Bev. Your last thoughts on Hereditary.
So I believe history is going to be very kind to Hereditary. I think history is going to be very kind to this decade of horror films, which we've been very generous to ourselves. But even among the decades collection that you just listed, Hereditary stands out for being one of the very best. It's earned a place on our shelf, but also deep in my psyche.
I was looking through briefly at my favorite films so far, and this might change by the time this podcast goes up, and it'll certainly change by the time we do our Oscars preview, and maybe change again when I see even more movies when we get into the later part of the year, June and July and so on. But right now, it's right there in my top three or four with Eighth Grade, which I loved. Love, Simon was wonderful. The Favorite was great. If I had to pick a top five, I think those would be the four in some kind of order, with Hereditary being the fourth.
Much like The Conjurer, film lovers have been wealthy with riches this year.
It was a good year.
2018 has been a great year for
the movies. Irony is, the Golden Globes were only a few days ago, and very few of those were the right choices in both TV or movies, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, the movies themselves were really good last year, maybe the best year in quite a long time, but so far at least, and maybe the Oscars will amend this, but Golden Globes were not good choices overall.
Golden Globes has got a lot of grief, not necessarily for their choices critically, but for their choices because they are both problematic choices. So they've been getting a lot of criticism for that. So the Oscars are, you know, voters are probably going to listen to that. And I think especially Bohemian Rhapsody can kiss their chances of an Oscar goodbye because of Bryan Singer.
I haven't seen Bohemian Rhapsody. I haven't seen Green Book. They were the big winners that night. And it seems like Bohemian Rhapsody will get a nomination for Rami Malek and maybe some technicals. But Best Picture, probably not. Yet it won the Drama Award at the Globes.
No, it won... Oh, no, that's right.
Because it's a musical, but it was not in the musical category.
Oh, my God. The Globes are so crazy.
People say Green Book is a drama with some laughs in it, but it was the comedy winner that night.
I love the Golden Globes, but that was the worst production of the Golden Globes I think I have ever seen. No fault to the host that brought a lot of charm to some very mediocre writing. They really tried. They were quite fun to watch, but it just could not save that broadcast.
And I don't know if anyone's going to honor this movie because no awards body seems to be giving Toni Collette The Sound. That would be a worthy nomination at the Oscars. The score. We're saying Best Picture and all the rest of it, but even just some of the lesser awards like sound or the editing or the music, and it probably will get nothing.
Like you, I still haven't seen enough movies to call my favorite movie of 2018, but I feel like Hereditary is the one that just keeps popping up as my favorite film of the year.
When we return in 7 days, we'll begin our fourth annual Oscar month. We'll do an Oscars preview show on February 18th, but we'll surround that with three Best Picture winners from the past. And our first will take us back to the 2009 champion, the little war movie that could, and did, take down the mighty Avatar, The Hurt Locker. So the coming attractions trivia for The Hurt Locker. In the infamous cereal aisle scene at the end of The Hurt Locker, does Jeremy Renner actually select a cereal or not?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about The Hurt Locker. But what if you just can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please check out our entire roster. We've covered hundreds of movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free for you. But while you're there, perhaps in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. We are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkled Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That is all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case sensitive.
Hail Beverly! Hail! Hail Beverly and Payman. Hail. Okay, now my lip hurts.
And cut.